and welcome to the Disability Education in Society podcast. This is a podcast for collective learning and unlearning in the struggle for intersectional liberation. We focus on educational realms, expanding to other societal areas. We share our stories as academics, as well as those of our featured guests, including disability activists involved with multifaceted dimensions of systems equity, self-determination efforts, anti-ableist, and anti-racist liberation. Join us as co-conspirators.
Dr. Alexis Padilla is a disabled lawyer, sociologist, theologian, and educator. Born and raised in Venezuela, Dr. Padilla has resided and conducted research and advocacy work in the United States for three decades. His first solo book, Disability, Intersectional Agency, and Latinx Identity, was published by Routledge in 2021. Dr. Padilla's second solo volume, Decolonial Disability and Social Epistemologies, is currently under contract, also with Routledge. It will come out next year.
Today, on the Disability Education and Society podcast, we are having a self-reflective conversation. And I thought that Alexis and I could talk about something that came up in one of the recordings. I think it was with Allison, where we were just having a discussion and Alexis shared this idea about an upcoming book. So we'll get into Alexis's upcoming book, which sounds very exciting, and do sort of like a self-interview, if you will, of our one of our co-hosts here. You could even call Alexis the main host, if you will. And so we'll have that conversation. And so before we do, I Alexis and I thought it would be pretty neat just to have some quick conversation about the statistics of the podcast. So we started the podcast probably about 3 months ago. And so I think maybe like many folks who do podcast work or even scholarly work are start monitoring, like, hey, what's, you know, who's connecting to our work, and maybe too much time doing that. But I think it would be good just to share with those in the community, like what are others in this community? Where are they coming from? Where are they listening from, if you will? And so I think that would be a wonderful start to the conversation, and then we'll get into Alexis's book and have a deeper discussion about that. What do you think about that, Alexis?
Yeah, it sounds great. I always think of podcasts as learning communities. So, you know, like every global classroom, which I guess is what we are. And of course, we are the main learners, not any teachers. I guess that's the good thing about being co-hosts in these things, is you're not really the teacher, but you're the facilitator, the conduit for the conversation to happen. So yeah, I'm really excited. I'm not familiar with these statistics, so I'll be as excited to hear them as you all are in the audience. So
yeah, so this is very authentic, because I just kind of sprung this on Alexis right before we got on. I said, hey, do you want to talk about the statistics that you haven't come across yet? But me, I have, because I've been monitoring it. So Alexis will be coming across these numbers the first time. And I do agree with what you said, Alexis, that it is a learning community and that we are the learners. Like I think when we share the statistic, you'll see that some of the sources of that learning is from me, who I enjoy listening to the podcast, listening to folks who've come and joined us and had so much insights to share. And that, you know, for me, it takes me a few times just to kind of listen and listen to really get some of the things. So I'll admit, like when we're live, sometimes, you know, I don't exactly process everything that we talk about in a really quick manner. I think you do, Alexis. Like I feel like you're right on it, and you make connections right away. For me, on the other hand, I feel like it takes more time, and that I need to like think about it. I need to listen to it several times before I could make some strong connections and say, oh, I get what Allison said. I get what Renita says. That to me helps me. And so this is, a way to think about the podcast as you mentioned, as we are learning. We're not just a co-host, but we are learners. Okay. So, and just made me think about another question for you, Alexis, before we get into the numbers. Were there some things like in that kind of, and this is a question that I'm just popping at you right now, Alexis, that jump out at you in all the conversations we had so far? I think we had 11 folks join so far, or maybe 10. I think 10 people joined. So do you want to share any sort of things that have come up for you in all these conversations?
Well, when we decided to start the conversations, we wanted to have a lot of diversity, both thematic diversity and in terms of the kinds of people who would be conversing with us. That for me, that's been sort of the main insight, how earth-shaking putting all these conversations together and get the cocktail of learning working. I think it's been very, very exciting. And thinking of what you were saying before about different, I'm going to call it thinking styles. I tend to be more of an associational. In philosophy, some people talk about pararational thinking, the thinking that's not really centered so much on the rational, but on intuitive connections. And I know you're very intuitive, but your way to make connections is deeper. It's like the deep river kind of reflexive approach. And I'm sure there are these many other thinking styles within our audiences, and perhaps some of them who are more interested in seeing, having visual experiences, they prefer the videos, or some of them prefer the audios. I think that we have in shaking the cocktail, so to speak, and I keep going to that metaphor, we have gotten a substance where the sum of the parts are greater than the parts themselves. So I feel like we have, even if it's only 3 months, I think we have combined very interesting components that we may want to enrich. And it would be great to hear from an audience, you know, in terms of what other themes, what kind of things they would like to hear more about in terms of what has already been presented here. And for me, I think there are several very interesting things that are sort of popping up in terms of my own research based on some of these conversations. So I feel that they have been a good sort of catalyzing set of components for a cocktail of learning. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Yeah, and I do. And that, just to pick up on the point that you mentioned there, and if you are listening, watching the video, and you have some ideas, and you feel like, hey, look, these are some areas that I think you all could talk more about, go deeper into, or I would be interested in learning more about, or if you want to come on and join us in the conversation, we'd love to have you here. We have a few other folks that will be coming up. I'm very excited about some of the future really awesome people that will be joining us in conversation. And we would like to also invite others as well. Like, maybe we don't know you. I mean, we're just kind of reaching within our networks. And so you might say, hey, I'm interested, and we would love to have that conversation with you. And if you have ideas, if you say, hey, this part of the podcast is not so great, but maybe you should not do that anymore. We're all up for that as well. So I like to, Alexis, what you said, like, hey, this is a community that we are in constant communication with.
Just to throw my own hat there, I really would like to see more Global South presenters, people that, approach us and say, yeah, I'd like to converse with you about disability issues in Africa. We haven't interviewed so far anybody from Africa. We have a good friend who works in South Africa, and hopefully we'll get a chance to try to converse with her. But she's not from the Global South. I'd love to see if we can talk to people with disabilities who are from the Global South, working in the Global South, sharing their research or their experiences or both with us. That would be my wish list of possibilities. So if you're hearing this and you are one of those folks, please let us know, because we're very interested in those kinds of conversations. Do you have any special wishes for possible presenters that we haven't tackled yet, Paula?
Well, I mean, I like that idea, and I think it's a great segue into the first set of statistics that we'll get into, which is the world kind of composition of our community. So maybe we'll get started with that, and maybe, you know, we can talk more about some certain wish lists there as well. Okay, so here what we have, Alexis mentioned, reaching more the Global South countries, and this is just for the audio version. So the video version I checked, it's all from the United States. But the audio version, as you could, I'll point out here, we have the United States as pretty much like 90% of the folks that are engaging in this listening podcast. We have Canada at about 2%, United Kingdom, Hong Kong, Honduras, Russia, Singapore, Finland, and the Netherlands. So our reach globally is pretty much global North countries. Well, your reactions, Alexis?
Yeah, I didn't hear any African country, right?
No African countries.
And probably no Asian countries either.
Hong Kong and Singapore.
Or Hong Kong and Singapore. Yeah, you're right. I think of those islands. I was thinking of the continent, the continental Asia. None of those countries. Only Honduras from Latin America. That's interesting. Nobody from Brazil, even though we conversed with Fernanda. That's also interesting to me.
Yeah, so a lot of places we are not reaching. I think we've gotten the U.S. and it's, I think you're right on point there, Alexis, with some of the major areas with major populations, talking about Asia, talking about Latin America, talking about Africa, that we would like to have a presence in, I think. And then having that, again, that community, the purpose is really for the community of learners. Now, if we shift to...
I'm sorry, how many people have listened to our podcast?
So we have 220 people have listened to the podcast. And I would say that number, again, I mentioned earlier, a lot of it in the U.S. is it's, you know, it's me. I'm the one that's tuning in and listening to some of the podcasts just because I enjoy learning from the conversations we have. And so in that 90%, you could see Oklahoma is a big chunk of that, about, you know, 25%. I don't know if you listen to our podcast, Alexis, or not.
I don't think I have, but I know my wife has listened to some of the podcasts.
Okay, so Oklahoma is our biggest pie fuel, 25%. California, we have a good chunk there, 18%. Illinois at about 13%. New York, about 8%. Texas, 5%. Michigan, Nebraska, Virginia, Minnesota, Arizona, Utah, Maryland, Mississippi, DC, Indiana, Massachusetts, Missouri, and Washington at the lower end, if you will.
And this is Washington, DC, or Washington State?
Well, both. We have DC, about 2 people, or 2 downloads, if you will, and Washington State, 1. Okay. And so, yeah, I mean, I would say, like, you know, for me, like the big population states, if you all are at the top, I would say the exception might be like Florida.
I mean, Florida, right.
Florida and Ohio, where, you know, big population states, but no reach there for us. So that jumped out at me. But I mean, I feel like it's we got a lot of states here represented. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the United States, it seems interesting. You mentioned Canada before. Does it say which provinces in Canada have tuned in yet?
Yeah, we have. So Canada was 5 and Saskatchewan. I don't think I've pronounced that right. I've heard it, but I haven't pronounced that. Do you know how to pronounce that?
I wouldn't pronounce it correctly either, so I'm not gonna try. But I that's a good with a province with a good indigenous population there.
Okay, so that's about 4 of them from Canada and 1 from Ontario. So those are the Canada representation.
That's really good, huh? Especially thinking that this is not one of the sort of the biggest or the most urbanized provinces from Canada. So I'm really glad to at least see that composition there.
Yeah, so that's, you know, just a little bit of a quick statistic analysis, if you will, or conversation that Alexis is just kind of getting into the numbers now after about 3 months. So I thought it'd be good just to have that conversation and for our community to know, like, you're engaging in the podcast. Who else is engaging in the podcast? Where they're coming from, and maybe where are some areas that could be better connected, if you will. And so
I'm a qualitative person, so for instance, these numbers will not tell us if or how many of our listeners are folks with disabilities, how they perceive themselves, you know, within the naming range, MAD folks, folks who prefer the neurodivergent nomenclature, or people who prefer other specific nomenclatures, you know, the intersection of queer disabled folks or the CRIP groups, or, you know, it's interesting to me, I guess only through some interaction with the folks who are listening who can tell us those kinds of things, we would probably ascertain those aspects as well, right?
Yeah, and yeah, to your point, both of us will identify as qualitative researchers, if you will, even though we talk a lot about math in this podcast. And I do like looking in the statistics, and I agree with your point that it does tell us something, and it also doesn't tell us a lot of things as well. So that's a great point and a good place. Maybe we could pause here and then and come and revisit these numbers later on. I know at least for now, I'll be monitoring these closely and maybe too closely. Obsession I think I have with this, but maybe later on I may be less obsessed. So it'd be good to shift the conversation then to talk about what the main thing we're here to talk about, which is Alexis, you and some of the things that you're working on. And we're going to talk about the book that you have upcoming. And before we do, I mean, we all of the people that come on the show, we ask them about their connection to disability. And so I'm going to pose that question to you, Alexis. So tell, if you would, just start with the story about you and your connection to disability.
So I'm thinking of a story that actually the trigger happened recently. But it takes me back to the time when I was a teenager, in terms of this idea of coming out as a disabled person. I was born blind, as I've shared several times. But believe it or not, accepting blindness wasn't a natural thing. And you would say, well, this is unrealistic. I mean, it's much easier for people born with a disability to live with it and see it as part of their identity. The truth is there are many factors that could hinder that process. I remember this sort of search in my family to look for cures, for miraculous cures. This is something we probably, I think we discussed with Ophir at some point, the whole idea that disability can be fixed somehow with some kind of miraculous or technological thing that takes it away. I had a student in a recent class I taught, is a disability and psychology course. And this student basically shared confessionally with me the fact that she has mental disabilities, but she cannot disclose that in her work environment because that would basically jeopardize, she would probably be fired. And you would say, well, in the United States, you have ADA, you have all these protections. But unfortunately, it's clear that there are some contexts where disability has no place. It's not just classrooms, as it happens with quote unquote regular classrooms where we know a lot of students very young are removed from those regular places and secluded into rooms and things. So for me, this made me think of this notion of pan-disability that you and I have written about. Some people like to talk about cross-disability because the student, when she wrote this note to me, she was saying, well, I wish I could be like you guys, blind, the people who have physical disabilities, because they're more visible and people know this and they cannot hide it. And you know, it's a confession. I really felt moved by the fact that she had the confidence to share this with me. But it also made me think of the divisiveness of disability categories, how they parcel out and prevent us from connecting to other folks who have different types of disabilities with certain assumptions that it's going to be different for them because they do this or they don't do that, or people perceive them this way or that way. So I felt this is a good story for me to share. The other aspect of her note was the issue of productivity, that she makes a huge amount of effort to hide the disability, to compensate for the kinds of issues that the disability engenders, or you know, that sort of issue of productivity versus fruitfulness, which I think is the thing that triggered our conversation when we were talking with Allison in our last podcast. I think that's the space that you would like us to start with. Paolo, how would you like us to play with this notion or the distinction between fruitfulness and productivity?
Yeah, so I really appreciate you sharing that story, and it does make me think a lot about the connections that we talked about with Allison about the hiding of disability and what you mentioned, you know, how much it takes to do that, and how much it takes to the level of effort and this like time and energy just for that, and you sharing about how it prevents a lot of the connections among this different disability folks and the community. I think that makes a great deal of sense to me. Just going back real quickly, you mentioned the ADA, and I just want to make sure people are understanding the ADA. If you just want to talk a little bit about what ADA stands for, and
Americans with Disabilities Act is actually a piece of legislation that has been criticized from other countries that are CRPD. CRPD it stands for the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which is a global United Nations convention that most countries have ratified, and the United States has not ratified the convention, in part because the Americans with Disabilities Act is more of a quote-unquote civil rights type of legislation that doesn't emphasize human rights in the way that CRPD emphasizes. And so some of the people who are more familiar with the CRPD framework see issues with some of the protections in the United States, because they are often driven by employers. A lot of the protections have been turned down by courts. So the law has lost a lot of its teeth from the original version that came out, that many folks with disabilities advocated for. And it was a huge success in terms of movement building in the early 1990s. And it was actually signed by a Republican president, which is also a surprising aspect of ADA. But I think it's an interesting thing to remember. For example, the student I was referring to, she works in a health context, a health providing institution. And so it really, I think, connects to the issue of distinguishing disability and sickness, for instance, and the idea that being quote unquote sick makes you unable to do these or those kinds of things, when in fact coming out for this particular person could probably make her a better both advocate for patients that are being seen in that context, and the relational connections, but it's all related to the fact that it's not a human rights type of protection, and it's set up in terms that allow for these quote-unquote compliance artifacts to be still in place and provide for discrimination against folks with disabilities, even though you have legislation that's supposed to be preventing those things from happening.
Hi there. While we intend to make our podcast as accessible as possible, we ask those that have the financial means to support us by subscribing as a patron to our podcast for as little as $5 a month. To subscribe, go to our website, disabilityed.podbean.com. By subscribing as a patron, you will help ensure that we can continue to create and share new episodes while supporting other co-conspirators who face financial and health difficulties. For those with financial difficulties, please connect with us about obtaining a free copy of our books and/or engaging in additional conversations with us. You can also support this show by hitting the follow button, share this podcast with among your network, and leave us a comment and positive rating. Your support means so much.
Yeah, and I think this is a good spot then to turn to your idea from the book that you have upcoming, and you're talking about productivity versus fruitfulness. And I feel like the ADA in many ways is imposed in a context of capitalism, if you will. And right. So how that then gets shaped into it's you have to comply in the workplace. This means that, I mean, I'm just kind of trying to make sense of this. It's like it means that you could be more productive, if you will, by complying to this law that we written. So it's the law. It makes sense to me, like you're talking about, if it's not a human right, like a right to live freely, but it's in service of capitalism, if that makes sense or not. And so maybe we could turn to this. I think you mentioned this is going to be the first chapter of your book when you talk about productivity versus fruitfulness.
Right. I'll talk a little bit about the background for this chapter in the book. The book is titled The Colonial Disability and Social Epistemologies. The field of the colonial disability is quite recent, because anybody who reviews the disability studies literature would notice that most of the writers are Global North people, and many of the things said are said from a Global North perspective. So part of what this book wants to do is to use the coloniality to subvert, to disrupt a lot of these pre-imposed sacred cows, social epistemologies. And one of those is Marxism. So chapter one is trying to engage with Marxian thinking as through a sort of decolonial critique of it. But I wanted to say something more about the what you said about ADA and productivity. For example, in the United States, employers can get away with not providing accommodations if they can demonstrate that a given accommodation is not, quote unquote, reasonable. So the reasonableness is an aspect that gives employers an advantage, even though the protections are there. Yeah, if in terms of productivity or the profitability of the business or whatever, you can demonstrate that this particular accessibility piece is unreasonable, then you just don't provide it. And there are many instances in court where this has happened, and many people have been, gone without accommodations. But it also applies to even the 504, Section 504, which is the legislation that in the United States regulates accommodations for students with disabilities taking, say, math classes. A lot of the things that Allison talked about, all of those accommodations are also framed in terms of this notion of reasonableness and a lot of compliance components. And so many programs can get away with quote unquote complying with the law without really providing a sense of inclusiveness that's radically, facilitating things for students. And it's all because of what you said, the framing of the conversation is around capitalism, productivity, and all these conceptions of the disabled folks as being citizens of second class or some kind of foreign entity that you have to quote unquote normalize through the accommodations, but only to the extent that it's not unreasonable, right?
It makes me think of like this, what you said, like who determines this reasonableness? And so this language in the law is very ambiguous, and maybe it's intended to be ambiguous. And for me, it's like, well, if the employer says it's reasonable, then it's reasonable. If the employer says it's unreasonable, then it's unreasonable. I mean, where so the power and the determination is not on the folks who say, well, I need this accommodation in this workplace. It's on the employer to say, well, it's not reasonable because it's not cost effective. I don't have the money. It's building this ramp is gonna be unreasonable because it costs too much. It's gonna disrupt the architecture of the building. You know, whatever the case is, I mean, they could come up with a million reasons why it's unreasonable.
Right. And legal theorists would say, oh, it the burden of proof is on the side of the employer, but the employer has all the power to demonstrate that it's unreasonable, because policymakers and judges are all in tune with the logic of capitalism, right? So if the employer says my business is gonna go bankrupt if we provide this accommodation, they come up with some numbers and they cook the thing. It's possible to be understood in the same terms by the judge, because the logic echoes well with their soul, if there is any soul to capitalism. And they're speaking the same language. This is what, similar to what Bourdieu talks when he talks about cultural capital in schools, right? That the white middle class mother who goes to talk to a white middle class teacher, usually a woman, right? They speak the same language, and so beyond aspects of race, you also have this cultural capital that allows you to be understood. While the very notion of accommodation is foreign. I mean, you're accommodating somebody that's there almost as a foreigner. If I don't accommodate you, it's likely that you may have to be fired. And it doesn't matter if it increases unemployment for people with disabilities. There is not a counterclaim built into the law that will really allow for people with disabilities to get the upper hand. So yes, it's a very interesting framework as far as productivity goes. But I think what's interesting for me in this chapter is the idea that Marx himself was ableist. There is a famous phrase that shows up in the Communist Manifesto, and it had been written before in some other writings by Marx himself. The Communist Manifesto is more of a, it's almost, that's what it is, a manifesto, a political text that Marx and Engels wrote together. But the real thinker there, the big scholar, was Marx. Engels was more of what we would call now an activist, and he funded essentially Marx throughout his life to be able to do the writing, because as a Jew, Marx could not work in universities in Germany or in other places. They were discriminated, not allowed to teach and have positions and be paid for those. There were some Jews that were rich that could teach, like Simmel, for example, is a famous sociologist who taught for free in a German university because he just didn't need the money and could do that sort of thing. But Marx was not able to hold a university position, believe it or not. But
if you don't mind, if we just talk a little bit about the significance of this person, Karl Marx, because, you know, in our previous, one of the previous episodes, when we talked to Anna, I think we asked Anna the question, you know, what, like, who is Karl Marx? I mean, why are you critiquing Karl Marx?
Well, I think
you talk about him being ableist, but what is the significance of Karl Marx in our world today as part of this community?
Right. When you talk about anti-capitalism, the first figure that comes to mind is Marx, because he was essentially theorizing anti-capitalism with the idea that we in advanced capitalist societies would be evolving towards socialism and eventually to communism. And none of that happened. But one of the things that's interesting about Marx is that all his theories were based on things that were happening in Europe. So to begin with, he was already very Eurocentric in his way of thinking. And the way he understands the transformations of society is also focused on issues of production, what he calls modes of production. For him, capitalism is a mode of production, and it's supposed to be evolving towards a new and better mode of production, which would be socialism and eventually communism. But the focus keeps being on relations of production and the issues of productivity, at least the way Marx has been typically interpreted. In my critique to Marx, I concentrate on that phrase. And the phrase says, to everyone according to their capacities and to everyone according to their needs. Some people now in philosophy like to use the capability model to talk about disability in terms of these functional capacities idea. There's a famous economist that came up with the idea. Some philosophers had embraced it. It's taken into some policies, the capabilities approach to look at disability in terms of the functional capabilities that a person has. To me, when Marx is saying to everyone according to their capacities, he's not really talking about intrinsic potentials, right, of humans. But it's been interpreted in terms of capacity for productivity, for production, for you know, it's an ableist idea. And of course, if you link it to this idea of needs, and Marx never thought of this idea of special needs, but in the present context, you connect it to special needs, then you have two dual components that are harming people with disabilities. You're saying, well, they are not capable and they have a special needs, right? So they will not be productive. We can warehouse them here, as they do with educational context, So what do you think of that critique, Paolo?
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing some of the context, and really, I think for many folks, clarifying this idea of Marxism, if you will, the meaning of it, because I think that names comes up a lot, yet folks, I would admit, even me, like sometimes just making that connection is like, okay, what I kind of understand what Karl Marx is all about. What does that mean in this context? And we talk about disability education society. And so I thought you did a really nice job of clarifying that. And then I think it then segues this nice to this idea of like productivity, because that's as and you, I think, argue for something that's a different kind of language or concept of productivity. And you talk about fruitfulness. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And this is interesting because when I started this analysis and I put together the chapter, I really wanted to smash Marx through that critique and sort of remain at a sort of decolonial anti-Marxist approach to the conversation. In the same handbook where Anne's chapter was published, there are several interesting articles that actually elevate conceptions of Marx that are really not centered on productivity, or reinterpreting a lot of Marxian technical concepts. In this chapter, I elevate an older book by somebody, a French thinker. His name is André Gorz. And he's an eco-Marxian thinker. He has a book called Path to Paradise that came out in 1984. And he basically argues there that Marx's real interest was to create a type of society that would facilitate not productivity in the sense that we understand it, but more fruitfulness, the idea of getting at a real potential. And he talks about a type of society, and he said, you know, we have the technology in 1984, he said, we have the technology and we have the ability to, because we're producing so much, to have societies where people would only work for about 5 years, almost like a military service of sorts. And then they could live in with a living wage sort of income. It's not really a wage, but it's a living income mechanism that would allow them to pursue all the artistic, all the kinds of things that they find fruitful in terms of their own soul searching, their own creativity, their own generativity, all these aspects that are really giving sense to our existence. So, I mean, from that framework, even within Marxism, you could talk about fruitfulness as a antidote to the capitalist obsession with productivity. I also critique, I will be critiquing André Gorz again, because it's coming from Europe, and a lot of these societies are indeed global North societies that have all these resources, many of which are actually taken from global South countries that are deprived of the ability to have those kinds of policies that they're talking about, you know, like you can see with a lot of the texts from the late 18th century, you have, you know, like the US Constitution or the documents from the French Revolution that are talking about freedom and good things for the Europeans, but a lot of pain for the rest of the world. So in that sense, I think we need to search for a sense of productivity that's really globally feasible, that is not dependent on the exploitation of Global South nations and Global South societies. So that's part of what this chapter is trying to frame, and especially emphasizing issues of disabilities, because within that model of the 5 years of work, et cetera, you could have people with disabilities pursue whatever they want to without having to be necessarily subjected to these 5-year requirements or these other things, or being seen as people who are not productive, because everybody is given the same type of structure, right? So you have a system where all citizens would be equal in terms of the pursuits of their potentialities, their abilities, their dreams, etc.
Yeah, it made me think as you were sharing these ideas, it made me think about like math education. So again, I'm very much grounded in coming from this angle of mathematics education, which has this notion of productive struggle. And so productive struggle, again, as we talked about in our last episode, is kind of the end all be all, if you will. I mean, that's all what all educators, teacher educators should strive to instill in their prospective teachers and their in-service teachers, and then teachers should instill in their students this idea that we all have to engage in productive struggle. And for me, that feels very icky in a lot of ways, because the way it gets taken up. So, for one, struggle, I think, has a long history of having this, I think of like freedom struggles. But then you add on this productive struggle that you have to be making progress in mathematics, which I think it goes against a lot of key principles. So I just wanted to share that idea because
it goes back to
your thoughts about that.
Right. It goes back to what Allison said about this. I think we were not recording at the moment when she talked about this notion of body capital, that we are all provided with different types of body and mind capital. So the productive struggle, quote unquote, of somebody with disabilities that has bodily or mind-related things that will make the struggle tougher, you're basically creating another way to exclude them from the process of doing and thinking mathematically, right? You are creating an ableist conception of mathematics. What if your struggle is fruitful and not productive? What would it mean in mathematics to have a fruitful struggle that's not productive necessarily, but it's fruitful in whatever other respects it could be? Because even the ways to measure productivity in that struggle are all constrained in terms of what sort of mathematical progress you're making, what kind of numerical this or that. There are all these sort of standardized ideas about what progress is supposed to mean.
And to your point, what you mentioned before is like also like those who are measuring productive struggle, like you are doing in I. Maybe an educator, maybe a school psychologist, maybe an aide, whatever the case is. It's not the student who's determining. Like
exactly, yeah. The true student-centered approach has to be fruitful, in their terms, not in somebody else's terms, especially the standardized terms of what mathematics is supposed to be like, right? Because it could mean something completely unmathematical, quote unquote, but tremendously significant for these individuals that are pursuing things that are fruitful in their own terms. Allowing for those kinds of spaces is fundamental. And you would say, well, you're in public schools, you're funding all of this with public monies, etc. But the mission is supposed to be student growth, is supposed to be these transformational things that are supposed to be happening for the student within the student's own term. I think that's more congruent with the sort of things that Anne was bringing up in terms of how she interprets Marxism and education, for instance.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation, Alexis. I know we're getting up, I guess, a time that we agreed that we would converse. And so we'll stop it there, and definitely not the end of the conversation. It's a great start to, I think, what other conversations we'll be having as part of this podcast. So again, thank you, Alexis, for sharing so much important insights. And I think I will be, again, listening to this podcast many times just to get a deeper sense of our conversation today.
Right. I want to share my email address for people who are listening to us, and if they want to volunteer with me or with Paolo for presenting, conversing with us, we're open to doing so, and perhaps insights into this chapter is a work in progress. I guess that's the good thing about talking about a book while it's been written. When I did my first solo book, I didn't talk about it until it was out. I think this time, having this opportunity to dialogue on the emerging elements, I find it very interesting and valuable. So my email address is, like my last name is A, Padilla, P as in Peter, A, D as in David, I-L-L-A, and then three more letters, D as in David, I, V as in Victor, at gmail.com. So it would be apadilladiv@gmail.com. And I'm sure Paolo can put it up in the in writing, so you guys can see it in the chat. And feel free to share your thoughts with me or with Paolo. Again, we are definitely interested in getting more presenters from the African continent, the Asian continent, and more Latin American participants, people who could converse about different topics and ideas. So we'd be very much open to that possibility.
Yes, and I'll put that in the show notes, Alexis's email address. And I also want to just say, like, that's how it's wonderful, again, that you know, there's an opportunity that there's a book that's upcoming. Alexis is going to be authoring, and these conversations that we're engaging in is going to be part of that book. And so if you connect with Alexis and you have conversations, I'm sure that is going to shape the way the book comes out. And then we could talk about when the book comes out, we could have additional conversations and reflective conversations as well.
And I'm starting quite early. My book is going to be out next year. So if you want to do talk invitations on the book once it's upcoming or something, I'm also open to doing that sort of thing. As I said, it's the process. It's been different for me in terms of being more open to conversing with folks as the ideas are emerging, because I think it does produce a different experience when it comes to writing and thinking of things. So,
yeah, like more of community kind of approach.
Yeah,
right?
The learning community concept. Absolutely. All right. We keep shaking the cocktail then.
Shaking the cocktail. That is a phrase. You're going to have to copyright that. So
yeah, shaking the cocktail.
Shaking the cocktail. So with that, we're going to end the show, and we're going to until next time, we'll have a guest and we'll have a deeper continuing conversation. Thank you all.
Thanks, Paolo.
Thank you so much for engaging with the DES podcast. We post new episodes every few weeks. The DES podcast is made possible and sustainable in solidarity with you and those who generously volunteer their time to converse with us. We hope you join us on our next episode.